All right, the topic this evening, can I borrow a kidney? Brother, can you spare a kidney? Organ donation in Jewish law and ethics. This is an extremely, extremely not only important topic, but also a hot topic. It really is. The you know, Torah journals and periodicals in the past number of years, probably since, especially since the late 70s into the 80s, have been talking a lot about this, and there's been a lot of back and forth, both in response to, I would say, not that much back and forth of late, but certainly initially when this this whole notion topic first broke about the halachic, the Jewish legal reaction to the notion of organ donation from a variety of different perspectives and aspects of this that I'll take a look at tonight. This became and still is obviously an extremely relevant and an extremely important topic. The reason why it's extremely important. The reason why it's extremely important is twofold, really. First of all, because this is obviously something that's just an extremely important topic in terms of the medical world and in terms of patients who are both in need and capable of donating organs for those who are in need. And also because it's really rare, I would say, that you find a topic in Jewish law where the stakes are so high and, as such, the margin for error is really nil, meaning on either side, right? We have a general sort of feeling that, listen, if we need to, we can always be strict, right? If we're really in a jam and we're just not wholly comfortable with the notion of being lenient in a particular area, you know, does it necessarily kill us to be a little bit more strict? Here's a great example. This is a fairly good example, although, like, I'm looking at Isaac, and it's actually not such a great example. But here's a fairly good example, right? If we do or we don't spend the week of Pesach eating quinoa, we'll survive, right? So at least now it happens to be that really in the course of the past year, and I don't want to get off topic, but in the course of the past year, it's basically become unanimous, at least amongst the major kashrus organizations, that quinoa is wholly acceptable for Passover. Having said that, when it was still under debate and it was still under scrutiny and there was still an argument about it going in either direction, the default setting to a certain extent can be, and maybe ought to be, it's not going to kill anybody to not eat quinoa for that one particular week. Like, we'll survive, people. Let's just move on. So if we need to, we can take that particular approach, whether as a stopgap measure or even over the long haul. When it comes to this notion of whether or not to permit the notion of organ donation, the stakes are extremely high in both directions. And we'll get into a fuller analysis of that as we continue on. But first, and this comes with a disclaimer, I'm not a doctor. Believe it or not, right? I should have borrowed.
You spent last night at the Holiday Inn.
But I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night. I'm not a doctor. Humbling than that is that, you know, you can sort of you can fake a lot today, right? Because Baruch Hashem for Wikipedia. So I want to be very, very clear. I didn't even Wikipedia this. My understanding of this basic procedure in terms of organ donation, and I'll let the physicians in the room yell out and correct me. But I'm speaking in very, very broad terms, obviously, when it comes to all the medical aspects of anything that we discuss tonight. This really comes from a combination of discussions and quick little blurbs either discussed with or read from rabbis who would research this or just doctors and physicians that I happen to know. But basically, this is a very, very superficial glance, which is what we're getting at. But just the real basics, at least as far as I understand it. And by the way, there is an important exception to the rule that we're not really going to get into as far as this procedure goes. But this is the normative procedure. Basically, the notion of organ donation and harvesting usable organs. Okay, we're not speaking about somebody who is willing and interested as a 30-year-old in donating their kidney to somebody who's in need of a kidney. We're speaking tonight about the notion of organ of post-mortem organ donation, the idea of harvesting organs from a body once that body has at least potentially expired. Here's what happens. Brainstem death. So the basic need when it comes to harvesting organs is that the organs still need to stay fresh, basically. Now, the way that the organs stay fresh is, I mean, this is just the beauty of the organism that is the human body, that so long, I mean, we have our own, you know, refrigeration and preservation system that just works organically. So long as blood and oxygen continue to be supplied to the organs, they'll remain intact. This is barring any disease, etc. But as a basic function, if we have blood with oxygen that's being supplied to our organs, so those organs will continue to remain fresh. You get into a very basic issue then when it comes to the death of any human body. With the death of a human body, the blood stops pumping. And if the blood is no longer pumping, then if we don't have blood that continues to be pumped with oxygen continuing to be pumped towards the kidneys, as an example, then those kidneys are worthless because they're going to begin to decompose and die very, very quickly. So what you need to do is get into the human body at a juncture at which we can say that I can ethically, morally, legally, and halakhically harvest these organs, remove the kidneys, let's say, from a human being, because that human being is actually already dead, but there's still blood being pumped to those kidneys so that they're still fresh and still usable and can still be put into another body. So what we are looking at is that point at which, for the given human being, brainstem death has occurred. What's going to happen then is that the lungs are no longer going to produce oxygen on their own. They're no longer going to be breathing on their own. The brain is no longer controlling the various organs and all the other aspects of the body. There is no more there's no more blood flowing to the brainstem, and the brainstem is inactive. And if at that point we can say and declare that the person therefore is dead because they are no longer in control of their body in terms of their brain capacity and brain capability, so now we have an opportunity. And the opportunity arises in that if we can continue mechanically to pump the lungs so that oxygen continues to be pumped through the blood and so that the heart can continue to be kept pumping, that means that we'll still have blood circulating throughout the body, and that means that all the organs that we wish to harvest will stay fresh despite the fact that the person's dead, which is a golden opportunity. So as long as we have mechanical blood flow, right, which will take place by means of a respirator, if we have the lungs going on a respirator, so we have oxygen going into the lungs and we have the heart continuing to pump blood all throughout the circulatory system, so then the organs will stay fresh and we can go in and actually harvest the organs, and now we have kidneys that then potentially could be donated to another person who's in need, potentially a heart to a person that's in need, etc., liver. So there are really three primary issues that need to be addressed when dealing with this, the bulkiest of which is the second one, but just going in this particular order for whatever reason. The first issue that actually just arose before we started is the notion of kavod hamet, okay, the idea of dealing with a dead body in a way that Jewish law and Jewish tradition deems as being appropriate and being responsible and being honorable. Number two is, of course, the definition of death. This entire process, generally speaking, there are exceptions, but generally speaking, this entire process is predicated on the notion of brainstem death being defined as actual death of the human being, which then provides us with this opportunity to harvest organs after the person's already dead. The question is whether or not that is so in terms of the halachic perspective. And finally, depending on how we decide on that issue, what position am I in terms of then being able to receive organs, right? Are those two necessarily inextricably bound with one another? Or perhaps might there be a separation between, let's say, issue number two and issue number three, whereby I could say that I might define this as being inappropriate or halachically not acceptable in terms of harvesting the organs, but still put myself in position to be on the receiving end. Is that appropriate? Is that not appropriate? Moral, immoral, fair and legal, or totally non-halachic and prohibited? So the first issue, kavod hamet. So as a general rule, we know that we just had this whole program, right? The notion of kavod hamet is extremely, extremely important because we view the soul as continuing on for all eternity, but we also view the body as being the very holy receptacle of that and the home. Right, it housed the soul for all those years, and the body then needs to be treated with the utmost respect and dignity. So we know the whole notion of the Tara, and we know the whole notion of dealing with the body in a way that's proper and respectful. Ideally, we never leave the body alone from the time that the soul departs until the body is actually buried, etc., etc., and so on and so forth. One of the major issues when it comes to this notion of kavod hames that we're probably all familiar with, certainly if you've spent any time on or around the Chevra Kedisha, is that autopsies in Jewish law are a big no-no. We try to do everything that we possibly can to eliminate autopsies, even when they're otherwise scheduled, getting on the phone with the coroners, etc., unless there is a particularly pressing need, either that we ourselves can't possibly get out of, or some other extremely unusual, rare, extenuating circumstances. But as a general rule, we try to dissuade the coroner from performing any sort of autopsy on a human body because we believe that the human body needs to be completely and fully intact when it is buried. So much so, by the way, and this is something that Rabbi Zone spoke about in his presentation when he was here, that we try to collect any blood that may have too broad, but essentially we try to include any blood that may have been spilled or that may have left the body during the process of death. We try to include that along with the body for the sake of burial. Gauze pads and things like that, that all get buried along with the body, so that every component, even drops of blood, are buried along with the body when the body goes into the grave. So certainly, the notion, at least in a vacuum, the idea of doing anything to remove parts, entire parts of the body before it goes into the grave would be extremely problematic. Extremely problematic. Having said all of that,
good thing autopsies are so rare today.
Good thing autopsies are so rare. Yeah. 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 I mean, I've personally, I've found that they've been very agreeable over at the coroner's office. Usually doesn't. Yeah, I'm sure not. Who would? Right, I'm sure not. But it's But yeah, very, very agreeable. Usually doesn't take more than a phone call, at least to curtail it as much as we can. Even so, it usually means, well, we'll just take a couple of vials of blood for the lab report, which we also frown upon, but there isn't a whole lot we can necessarily do about it. At any rate, the notion of going in and removing an entire organ or multiple organs becomes highly problematic. Having said that, there is a basic umbrella rule that covers almost any other prohibition, law, whatever, that we otherwise have in Judaism. This is the notion of what we call pikuach nefesh. It's saving a life. Saving a life trumps all. Saving a life trumps everything. Except the three biggins. The three biggins. What are the three biggins?
Idolatry.
Murder. And
promiscuity,
yeah, not necessarily. We'll call it illicit relationships. Promiscuity, not necessarily. Not necessarily, but certainly illicit relationships. We'll say illicit relationships, yeah, right. Illicit relationships. Those are the big three. But aside from that, take something simple, something like Shabbos, something like kosher. As a general rule, if a person is stranded on a desert island, right, and he's got nothing to eat and he's at death's door, and along comes along comes a plane, and he sees the guy that he says, "Buddy, here it comes!" And he sends down a happy meal. So, Essen Gesundheit, right? Whatever you need to do in order to be able to survive, as a general rule, you need to violate Shabbos to be able to survive. You violate Shabbos. You need to violate kosher to be able to survive. So then you violate kosher. Anything and everything we violate for the sake of pikuach nefesh. Why? Because the Torah tells us to do so. Because the Torah tells us, v'chai bahem, and you shall live by them. Meaning that to God, a Jewish life, this is important, a Jewish life is more valuable than violating the Torah. Right? Now here's what we're getting there. So meaning I have not only the right, but I have the obligation to violate Torah law in order to be able to save myself, right? Because that's what God tells me to do. God says that he values my life more than the Torah that I might otherwise violate. Now, when it comes to these other items, these other, the big three, we have specific laws and specific textual references that indicate to us that that's not the case when it comes to these other three, that actually God prefers that we not commit idolatry. Our lives are less important to him than that we not commit idolatry. Or put other ways, put in a more positive way, there are some things that are more important than our own life. The idea of basic monotheism, of not succumbing and not submitting to idolatry, is more important than our own life. The idea of not killing another human being is more important than our own life. The idea of not submitting to illicit relationships is more important even than the preservation of our own life. Yeah, Naomi.
This all talk, what you're talking about, though, is what I may or may not do to save my life. But
includes another person also. So for me to save your life.
Yes.
For me to save your life. If I could figure out some way where my eating a bacon cheeseburger would save your life, Naomi, I'm there for you. And I'm still working on it. Still trying to figure that one out. And once I do, we'll talk. But yes, I can violate 610 biblical laws for the sake of saving your life. Yeah. Now, the question is, and this is a tricky one, but the question is, what are the limits of pikuach nefesh? Right, the idea, and here's, the easiest example, perhaps, to utilize to understand, is that, you know, we have a general precept, which is charity begins at home. So charity begins at home. That means that I take care of my family first. So I could understand that there might be certain things that I would violate for the sake of saving my own family, that I wouldn't necessarily violate for saving another person that I might love very much, but just isn't the same as my own family. Certain things that I would do for a family member that I wouldn't necessarily do for anyone else. The question is, what are the limits of pikuach nefesh vis-a-vis not just a Jew, but then a non-Jew? What are the limits of that? What are the parameters of what we can and can't break in order to be able to save the life of a non-Jew as well? Now, within this whole framework, as a general working kind of approach, we are reluctant to break biblical law, but we are very much open to breaking rabbinic law or other such, lower level mitzvah when it comes to the notion of pikuach nefesh, even for beyond. I mean, the idea of, even for those beyond the purview of being members of the tribe, we have a certain code that we live by, and part of that code is that we're there to take care of one another. In a greater sense, we're here to sort of be a beacon of light to the entire planet, but charity begins at home. So whereas I may have a mandate to break any other precept that God has given me, which is of extreme importance, but still I'm supposed to break it for the sake of my own family member, meaning another member of the tribe, another member of the Jewish people, my mishpacha, not necessarily so when it comes to anyone else. Having said that, when it comes to rabbinic law, we certainly do. So that becomes part of this conversation. First of all, the question is, when I give up an organ, or when one gives up an organ, isn't there a chance to save a Jew? That organ basically goes to a list. If the first person on that list, or the first match, is a Jew, then there's the possibility that I'm actually saving a Jew. Ordinarily, we totally discount that everywhere else in Jewish law. Why? Because of the notion of what we call rov, majority. Majority always rules, majority always wins in matters of Jewish law. For instance, right, classic case, so we have the drop of milk that falls into a huge vat of chicken soup. It's considered to be a non-entity. Why? Because there's such an overwhelming majority of chicken soup compared to that drop of milk that we look at that drop of milk as being such a nothing. A garnishtel. What about when it comes to the possibility that maybe the first person to rise to the top of the list is necessarily going to be is necessarily going to be a Jew. It's a pretty unlikely possibility, pretty small chance. Nevertheless, the whole notion of rove becomes lifted when it comes to matters of pikuach nefesh. For a minute possibility, I may be in position to be able to do something that otherwise would be a desecration of Jewish law, like the desecration of a body after death, for the sake of perhaps, perchance, saving a Jewish life.
What about the probability? So let's say 2% chance would be a Jewish person, roughly speaking.
Right.
But so it's a non-Jew that gets it. That means a Jew who's next might move up the list.
That becomes part of the whole. We'll get back to that point in a couple. Yeah.
Can I ask the doctor a question?
Yes. There is a list, right? Done by Steve Sullivan, would know better. They're not the proper organization, right?
But if I have a family member who I know is compatible with my kidney, for example, how does that work? And I'm willing.
Well, you're more likely to match a family member. Than
right.
Else.
But I mean,
I don't know the answer.
Does that family member get my kidney, or does my kidney go to somebody else higher on that list?
Steve knows some of the millions. I don't know.
What's your answer, Steve?
I'm sorry.
I don't know.
But it was relevant.
One short blurb that I did come across did note that you can put in specifications about who you do or who you don't want to get your organ, even an entire group of people. It's obviously frowned upon in the organ donation community. That's at least in it was like a footnote in an article, so I don't have more than that for you. Yeah, Richard, please.
When it comes to kidneys are basically free. Okay, you're on a list.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the list is determined by a number of factors. One of the factors is first on the list. The other is how compatible. How is this kidney going to be able to help somebody or not help somebody on the list? So they have to decide whether the potential receiver of the kidney is going to be able to use the kidney or not.
Right.
And this has to do maybe if they have a history of alcoholism repeated and whatever, they might pass the list. But even generally speaking, a person who is one of the Al-Rosha, one of the worst people in the world, and he was first on the list, he will get the kidney or she will get the kidney before one of the best husses in the world will get it.
Right.
Now, when it comes to other organs are not free. So, and you see people raising money to get organs many times.
Right.
So that's a different kind of a list.
And is that true, Richard, even in reverse?
A free list.
In terms of the donor, meaning what you're saying, I think...
The donor buys an organ.
But what about in reverse, meaning the Russia is going to rise to the top of the list. Does the person who's donating, who's serving as the donor of that kidney, does he have a right or she have a right to label, I don't want it going to that mom's?
You're not
going to
know who that person is.
You won't know.
Yeah.
Can I say that I want it to go specifically? It works out that as the person happens to be, we believe, at death's door, on his deathbed, he knows that he has a nephew, and does it work out that way?
I'm not sure.
That's a Steve question. Steve Selman.
Right.
That's interesting.
It just doesn't make sense. Okay. I was always under the impression that a relative who is matched to the need person who needs it can do that.
Yeah, but that's living related. It's different.
Living
related, you can say.
Right. Meaning, if I as a 30-year-old want to give,
I wanted to clarify when Eric brought his question out.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like it was more connected to the other element of organ donation.
Right. Well, that's why I wonder if it would have to work out as such that as a
daughter needs a kidney, father.
It would need to be that it happens to be that this, we know that our 95-year-old uncle who's really, deteriorating quickly, but if we get his kidney, it can go to the niece or whatever.
So many other organs, you can't. you can't give it up.
Right, right, right. No, you need for it to work out in a scenario in which the person who's dying has somebody in mind that they would like to give it to. Will. That would be a really unusual scenario. But let's say it happened. Right. Then I wonder what the case. We'll have to ask Steve.
Brain death is not always the criteria of death. And more recently, in certain cases where somebody's heart stops and there's no prospect of it starting again, for example, then under certain circumstances that can be declared as a time of death.
Right. There is this notion of NHBD, of non-heart beating donation. But it needs to take place very, very quickly, right? Meaning, what we're shooting for here is an opportunity whereby the organs are still fresh because blood has at least recently been drawn to that area, or at least recently been circulated to that area, and we can go in and take the organs very quickly, and they're still fresh enough to then be able to donate. Ordinarily, that's going to happen if we can keep the lungs going, but there's brainstem death. So the question... Right. So just very, very quickly, halachically, the issue that we get into there is that halachically and practically, that needs to take place. The organs that need to be harvested in such a quick period of time after the heart stops beating, that we don't know that halachically we would really rely upon such a thing. So this actually becomes the better bet from a halachic perspective to be able to say that the heart is beating continuously, but nevertheless, the person is clearly still halachically dead, perhaps, because he's brain dead, or because of brain stem death, specifically. Yeah, Eric?
Okay, so we're talking about organ donation post-death.
Yeah. Yes, okay. Yes.
What about organ donation pre-death? I mean, I don't want to...
Great.
Go into it, it's fine.
It's great. It's not just fine, it's great. It's great, yeah. Saving a life, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, no problem whatsoever.
Okay.
I mean,
I would imagine that...
It's the personal question of who do you want to give up a kidney for. I mean, you know, we have two of them for a reason.
It's not really altering your soul. It's altering your body.
No, it's not altering. I mean, look, the same way that there... If my...
The soul is unchanged.
The soul go... There, when we speak about... It's interesting. When whole limbs are amputated, actually, they are set aside to be buried with the person. Right? Either frozen or buried at a plot that ultimately, when entire limbs are separated, not when it's like, it's not like you have to walk around your entire life with, you know, a box of Kleenex wondering if I ever get a paper cut, I have to hold on to the blood, and that's not considered to be, you know, life source. The notion of, but anyway, yes, what we're talking about here, if you have an opportunity as a living being, yeah, to save a life, 100%, yeah, no issue whatsoever. Even for post-mortem donation?
Post-mortem.
Interesting.
However, you can't restrict the donation on the basis of age, gender, race, or ethnicity.
Okay. So I can say I want Yonkel Hirschkowitz to get it, but not because Yonkel Hirschkowitz is Jewish and white and not black.
Right.
Right. Right.
That's who I'm saying.
Assuming there's a match, though.
I don't care. Put him in it.
I really don't like him.
I don't like Yonkel Hirschkowitz. He didn't give me an Aliyah. Put it in. See what happens. Put it in.
Go, I'll take it home.
Okay, let's keep moving. One, just a couple more as far as this notion of kavod hamet, right? A couple of other things to point out is that, again, there's a distinction between biblical prohibition or rabbinic prohibition if we're speaking about violating what would otherwise be a Jewish law for the sake of saving a life, which is important, but is not a Jewish life. So, first of all, one issue is whether or not we might be able to presume, right, in a very, very general sense, if we can presume that the doctor's a non-Jew, right?
There your answers are not as good.
Right, but it's still majority. Still majority, right? So in terms of the majority of such surgeons being non-Jews, now what does it become? It becomes an act of asking a Gentile to perform an act which for me is prohibited, which for him is permitted. Right, a non-Jew is not bound by the notion of kavod hamet,
right? The way that a non-Jew can cremate another non-Jewish body. Right? There's nothing wrong with that. It's specifically when it comes to a Jewish body that we have these laws, and we're bound by them. So what do we call asking a non-Jew to do something which is permitted for him but prohibited for me? It's called amir la'akum. We do it all the time. We're not supposed to do it all the time, but we do it. We rely upon that for matters of the congregation, right? The notion of having Dave come in and doing something which is a necessity for the congregation, turning on the lights and turning off the security system as a general ongoing sort of thing, that's something that there are times that that we actually do employ that. And as a general rule, it is always the case that that is only a rabbinic prohibition. Right, my going over to my neighbor's house and saying, "Hey, by the way, can you come over and we forgot to put the chicken in before Shabbos. Can you roast me a chicken in my kitchen, for Shabbos lunch?" It's a rabbinic prohibition. I can't do it myself. Asking a Gentile to do so would be a rabbinic prohibition of asking a non-Jew to do that which I myself am not permitted to do according to Jewish law. So still, because it's a rabbinic prohibition, though, there may be much less of an issue that we have here in the first place. Correct. Yeah. In general, the idea of a Shabbos goy is not permitted. Yeah. We employ the notion of a quote unquote Shabbos goy for specific circumstances. Generally, matters pertaining to the entire community or matters of extreme importance that otherwise would totally curtail, your ability to have a basic, functioning, normal Shabbos kind of thing.
Well, biblically, it's not permitted, but...
Rabbinically, it is prohibited. Biblically speaking, the laws are only for me, the laws aren't for anyone else. So I have no biblical prohibition against asking a Gentile to perform something on my behalf, which is prohibited for me. But rabbinically, it is prohibited. The rabbi stepped in and said, "This is crazy. We're going to end up in a scenario in which you have, if you're wealthy enough, you just have a Gentile follow you around all of Shabbos, and it's not Shabbos anymore. You go to the office, you go to work, you have the secretary answer all your phone calls, write out, or sign your name on everything, hit the photocopy machine, and then you don't have Shabbos anymore." Having said that, so in these scenarios where it would only be a rabbinic violation, is that if the external appearance, which I don't know all the ins and outs, both medically and also halakhically, what we deem intact and what we deem not intact, but if the external appearance of the body remains intact, then it may only be a rabbinic violation of what we call nivul meit, the opposite of kavod hamet, of defacing the actual body, even after.
External appearance is not.
So I don't know to what extent, even just halakhically, I don't know to what extent that needs to be. To what extent we say that, yeah, the external appearance is essentially intact enough that we don't consider this to be a biblical violation. Meaning we don't have an entire, I don't know if it's just a matter of an entire limb missing, but this is one of the arguments, at least, that's raised. Now, and Steve, this goes back to your point before, that in general, one of the other things that we need to constantly be concerned about, this is really why the stakes are raised so high in terms of this entire conversation, this entire dialogue, is that what effect is this going to have on other Jewish recipients? What if it became publicized? What if there was a full expose in New York Times Magazine or something like that about how the Jewish community will only submit to being recipients but will not submit to being donors? Bad for business. Really, really bad for business. And it may be a fair claim to a certain extent. So that's one of the really important pieces that we need to keep in mind throughout this entire conversation is what happens when that takes place. And then not having anything to do with it being an act of even anti-Semitism per se, but just saying, listen, if you guys want to cling to your religious beliefs, by all means, that's okay. We're not saying that we dislike you because you're Jewish. What we are saying is that if as a result of Jewish beliefs you refuse to ever give an organ, then you can't possibly be in position to say, but we'll receive them from everyone else. That's just not fair. And you can imagine an argument being levied. You can imagine a bunch of people claiming it to be anti-Semitism, which it probably wouldn't be, frankly. It's just, it's fair and square to a great extent. So this has a ripple effect ripple effect on the rest of the Jewish community in terms of if I don't give mine because of Kavod HaMeis or whatever, then what kind of indirect effect will that have on the Pikuach Nefesh potentially of the greater whole, of the greater Klal, and their inability perhaps to as effectively down the path being able to receive an organ themselves. Okay. Yeah, Eric.
Okay, can I go back to the rabbinic versus the biblical issue? So, what would a modern-day rabbi recommend to a family?
It's complicated. I'm giving a whole class about it, actually. You can attend. It's the whole concept is really, that's one angle, one particular angle, which is not even the most significant. The most significant is the second one. And this is where it becomes so, this becomes such a divisive issue, not that we can't, you know, kiss and dance and, you know, get along, but it becomes such a divisive issue that this really becomes the kicker in terms of polarizing, you know, different authorities, and some saying that absolutely yes, and that it's not just that you may, but you absolutely must, and some saying absolutely not, this is heinous. So it depends which rabbi you ask. You're welcome to ask me as soon as we turn off the iPod. Okay. Definition of death. So this is really, this more than anything is what this issue really, really boils down to, is does the halachic perspective, the halachic definition of death, does that or does that not track and parallel what we've now accepted as the American legal definition of death? If, according to American law, we may consider brainstem death to be death, the person is no longer alive. If the person is no longer alive, it's not considered murder to go into his body and remove his heart, his kidneys, and his liver. Would halacha say the same thing, or would halacha not say the same thing? So just go through the cartwheels on your own. If halacha doesn't say the same thing, then the notion of going into somebody's body and removing his liver and kidneys and heart while he's still alive, despite the fact that he's brain dead, but his heart was still beating, if that's considered a living person, then that is what we call in halacha murder. The stakes are extremely, extremely high in both directions. Because of, now on the flip side, remember throughout this conversation what we just mentioned. What do I do, first of all, if I'm in position to potentially save a person's life? I have an obligation to do so. And also, what is then the ripple effect throughout the Jewish community, throughout the international organ donation community, when we say, as a policy, no, the Jews will not give, but yes, we are more than happy to take. Right. How long is it going to take for somebody to draw another caricature of like a crooked-nosed Jew, you know, with a money bag in one hand and like a kidney in the other, right?
3 minutes.
3 minutes. So, to get into this issue, we have a really, really interesting conversation that takes place in the Gemara in Yoma, okay, on Pei Hei Amid Aleph, on page 85a. The Gemara describes a person who is trapped under a pile of rubble on Shabbos. Because let's make it interesting. Now, without getting into the conversation of why it is and for what reason it is, it would be prohibited as far as the rules of Shabbos and the laws of Shabbos to remove the rubble, suffice it to say that it would be. It would be prohibited to remove, ordinarily speaking, to remove, to clear away a pile of rubble on Shabbos. But you have a person trapped underneath. So what's the law? While I'm eating my bacon cheeseburger, because I think it might help. I gotta save a life, so I also gotta violate the Shabbos. I went to Wendy's on Shabbos, and that's where I got it, because I think it might help. So the person is trapped under the rubble on Shabbos. We have to do everything, violate every rule in the book except for the big three, the three cardinal sins, to be able to save him or her. So that means even acting in violation of Shabbos. So we start to pull off the rubble, and then we get to the question of, how far do we go? So the Gemara says, isn't that great? The Gemara says that we actually have a dispute. How far do we go? What happens if we start pulling off this rubble and then we see that the person is there? And the person shows no signs of life whatsoever. So on the one hand, we have Pikuach Nefesh, saving the life. On the other hand, we have Shabbos. So in a vacuum, on a Tuesday, no big deal, clear off the rest of the pile of rubble and ensure that the person really is not alive, and then deal with the body accordingly. What do we do on Shabbos? Every time I pull off this brick, it might be a violation of Shabbos, if not for the fact that it is pikuach nefesh. So I'm not a doctor. So we say, even suffek pikuach nefesh, for the sake of even so much as a doubt about the potential ability to save a life, we still continue to remove the rubble. Now, as you can imagine, in an ordinary circumstance where you see that there's a human body, you know, buried that you're unearthing from this rubble, nobody's thinking clearly, and you're just pulling this stuff off. But, as we find throughout the Gemara, we remove human emotions for a couple of minutes to think about it as just logically as we possibly can. Because this is going to provide really important precept and principle for and precedent for all other areas of Jewish law, or at least some other areas of Jewish law becomes important. So, we say, conceptually at least, right, if you're not caught up in the heat of the moment, and you start to unearth the rubble, you start to unearth the person from beneath the rubble, and you realize absolutely no signs of life. So how far do you go down to say that this person really is dead? Yeah?
Well, don't you have a precept in there that you have to take care of the mace, regardless of Shabbos?
You might be able to ask a Gentile to be able to remove the rubble, but in terms of your own involvement, not necessarily. Not necessarily. So the question is, what do we do here? What do we do? At what point do I say that the person's dead? I'm not saving anyone anymore.
You can't tell that just by looking at him, no matter what you think or what the conditions are.
Well, at some point you can. I mean...
Yeah, you can. I mean, if there's a 10-ton brick and her head is squished flat, yeah, okay.
Then you can tell. Yeah, right. Right, if it's like a Bugs Bunny cartoon, right? Yeah. If he has an anvil on top where his head used to be, then you can tell. piano, right? So this becomes the question. So what the Gemara says is that, as you would figure, it's disputed. You have two different opinions. How far do you have to go? Some say that you have to expose his nose, and some say that you have to expose his heart. Why would you have to expose his heart? Because if his heart's not beating, then he's dead. Why would you have to go to his nose? Because if he's not breathing, he's dead.
But today we wouldn't accept that.
So we have two different opinions.
Well, shock him.
Right, well, very, very important. Very important. So we have two different possibilities. Now, Rav Papa chimes in and says, by the way, the whole thing's irrelevant if you start with the head. As we're going through this rubble, this whole dispute is about when you've uncovered all of this rubble and you see feet. So now that I see feet, how far do I go? Is it enough to just go to the heart, or do I have to go all the way up to the head? Everybody agrees, though, that if you start unearthing this person and you see his head, you only need to go up to the nose. Because once you go up to the nose and you can tell whether or not he's breathing, put a feather near his nose, if you can see whether he is or is not breathing, that will be the determination as to whether or not he's alive. Meaning, if he's not breathing, says the Gemara, don't bother clearing any more rubble because he's dead and there is no need and no sense and it wouldn't be permitted to continue clearing rubble on Shabbos for the sake of a dead person, only for the sake of a live person. That's based on whether or not he's breathing. So what does that say? What that would say is that if he is brain dead, if one is brain dead, so that he's not breathing on his own anymore, that ought to mean that we can halachically say that he's dead, which should also mean that if we can manufacture breathing, if we can mechanically have him breathe so that he's still getting oxygen to the rest of his body through his heart and his circulatory system, then we have organs that we can harvest even though the person's already dead. Analysis and application of that particular Gemara. First, we have the Chassam Sofer, very important scholar from what used to be Pressburg, what is today Bratislava in Western Europe, from the late 18th and early 19th century. Chassam Sofer says that respiratory failure is death, exactly what you would think from this Gemara, which ought to then indicate that brainstem death is death. If a person can't operate his lungs anymore on his own power, then he's dead. The Maharsham, isn't that a nice picture of him? Maharsham, Rav Shlomo Mordechai Shwadron, who lived a little bit after the Chassam Sofer, says that the notion of breathing, the Gemara points to breathing because it is almost a surefire indication more than anything, but it's not the definition. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who lived just the he passed away in the what's that?
Red Auerbach.
No, this is a different one.
That was his father.
This is his uncle.
His uncle.
Looks just like him. He was the sort of the Israeli counterpart to Rav Moshe Feinstein, meaning a halachic authority of that stature in Israel, and was very, very involved in many of these kinds of questions about one of his first, I think the first book that he ever authored was on the laws of utilizing electricity on Shabbos. So very involved in these kinds of things. So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, and this sort of piggybacks to a certain extent on the Maharsham, he reminds us that there were no means of resuscitation in Talmudic times. So perhaps in Talmudic times, and it's not just that, you know, they didn't know any better or they were working with, you know, the medical opinion of the time. There was no other way. If a person stopped breathing, that was it in the time of the Gemara. So you hold a feather by that guy's nose, and if he's not breathing and you don't see that feather moving, he's dead because there's no way to save him. But today, clear. And there are things that we can do to bring a person back.
You do CPR.
You shock them.
Choke.
You what?
Choke.
Unchoke. We want to unchoke him.
Yeah.
You can unchoke him. There are all kinds of things that you can do. So if Auerbach says that whereas that may have been appropriate in the time of the Gemara, it's not going to be a contemporary modern day definition for death. So it works with a Maharsham, meaning that it's an indication, not a definition. He goes one step further, saying that today it's not even an indication. You have no right to assume that the person's dead just because he's not breathing. Let's see what we can do about it. Another interesting halachic source. Yeah, Danny, please.
So I want to try to ask this as seriously as possible. But you've got this guy under the rubble from an earthquake or whatever.
Right.
And you uncover him to the point where you can see his breathing and his heart. And then, if I'm using the word properly, there's no Rachmanis to get him the rest of the way out because it's Shabbos?
If we know that he's dead, meaning once we've gotten to his heart.
No, we see that he's
dead. Oh, if he's breathing? No.
It's like, come
No, sorry. Okay, let me be really clear. What the Gemara is saying is at what point can we say that he's dead? And once we know that he's dead, we stop clearing. We say at the point that you get to either his nose or his heart. Meaning, if we're at his nose and we see he's not breathing, then he's dead. If we get to his nose and we see that he is breathing, we don't just say, all right, we'll see you at Chalashidus, walk it off. No. We finish clearing, and we pick him up, and we...
I was hanging there.
No. Yeah. Remember, you're raining! We'll see you in Joel. No. We get him out. It'll help. I'll join you. We do whatever we need to do to save him. Absolutely. Okay? Next halachic source, all right? And this comes from a Mishnah. If you're if you get a little queasy, don't look at the next picture. The Mishnah in Aholos. The Mishnah in Aholos, which deals with ohels, deals with tents. It deals with tents.
Snakes.
It's a lizard. It's a lizard. It's not a snake. It's a lizard.
A lizard is a...
So what happens is, this entire section of the Mishnah deals with at what point does everything within a tent become tame, become impure. Important for Kohanim, important for Teruma, important for all kinds of things. If there is something that is impure, like a dead vermin or a dead or a corpse, a human corpse, that's in a tent, everything within that tent or edifice or space or building under that same roof becomes tamei as well. So here's the question. What about an animal? At what point do we determine that the animal is really dead for us to say that therefore everything that was in that space with it also becomes tamei, also becomes impure? So what the Mishnah describes is, let's say you have a lizard. And the lizard was decapitated. Then the lizard is dead. Now, you'd say, well, obviously, not necessarily, because what happens if the tail continues to move? So what the Mishnah points out is that despite the fact that the tail continues to move, it's called mifracheset, pirchus, pei resh chaf vav samach. It is an involuntary movement, and even though it continues to gyrate, it has nothing to do with the with the living viability, obviously, of the animal, and therefore it is considered to be dead. Like a chicken, because you go to the shaykhid, and even after the chicken gets the... Then what happens to the chicken? The chicken does this, right? Sometimes 4 minutes for a long time. Now, that doesn't mean that the chicken necessarily died immediately, but as the blood drains, it could continue to kick its legs.
You could have quit while he was ahead.
So despite the fact that the lizard's tail continues to wag and continues to move, we still say that the lizard is dead. What does that mean? So there are two ways to analyze this, and obviously this becomes a really, really important source then for those who wish to say that organ donation and that brainstem that organ donation is permitted and required, and that brainstem death becomes the definition, the halachic definition of death as well. So the analysis of this according to a pro-donation perspective, first of all, what they do is a blood flow test. And this proves what they call, apparently, the hole in the head, which is that they inject... By the way, there are all kinds of issues with even so much as touching and handling a dead body during the period of time that we say it is right at the point of death. But it's sort of immaterial because the body invariably has an IV, and what they're able to do is place radioisotopes into the IV, and those then get carried away by the circulatory system. And they basically can get a snapshot of the radioactive movement within the body. And what they can find when there's brainstem death is that there is no more blood flowing to the brainstem. It basically shows a hole in the head, that there is blood flow all throughout the rest of the body, but nothing to the head. So despite the fact that the head is anatomically connected to the rest of the body, essentially the head, the body has been decapitated. There is no more head as far as the blood flow is concerned. So despite the fact that we find continued functioning of the organs, that's no more than the lizard's tail that even after being removed from the body completely, totally severed, continues to shake. What's that?
Give a spell check
error.
Tail.
Doesn't come through on spell check, yeah. I hate those. It doesn't, right. A spell check error, right. Yeah, exactly. Wait, let me think if I could have meant that somehow. The lizard's tail, yeah.
The tail of the lizard.
Right? So the fact that the heart continues to pump, the fact that the kidneys continue to function, the fact that that the liver continues to function on whatever level and whatever scale, it's no different than the tail that continues to wag and gyrate even after being totally severed from the body. So we can say that this human body has effectively been, as far as halacha is concerned, decapitated. Further example, by the way, we know what Rocky Mountain oysters are?
Yeah, but how is that on there?
So, there is a halacha in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch deals with a question about Eiver Min HaChai. Eiver Min HaChai is eating a limb or any part of an animal that was severed from the animal before the animal was dead.
Right.
So, meaning if you cut off a leg, that's a big no-no even for the Gentile population. Yeah, it's one of the seven Noahide laws.
It's a Noahide law.
So you may not cut off the limb or any part of an animal before it's dead to be able to enjoy it, even if you only then eat it after the animal subsequently died. So the Shulchan Aruch discusses a case in which the...
Isn't that how all animals are eaten? They're killed when they're alive.
That's the way we eat animals. And it's a good thing. Conceptually,
the animal's still alive and you cut an arm, a limb out.
What if you cut off the animal's leg and then you roast it and the animal's still alive? That would be prohibited. You're thinking, like, who's interested, right? It's like, take it for granted. It is a biblical prohibition, not just for us. It's one of the seven Noahide laws. You have to imagine that this was popular practice, if this was important enough to ban for the entire planet, right? Noahide, meaning all children of Noah, which means the entire planet. It's the way that we refer to the seven laws that are applicable according to the Jewish worldview.
So you gotta kill the whole animal, make sure the animal's dead, and then eat it.
Yeah. That doesn't mean that you have to shecht it and salt it and everything. If you're a Gentile, you can eat it however you want, but the animal must be killed first. You put a bullet through the deer's head, and you enjoy it however you want. But don't cut off the hind leg of the deer, watch it, fall over itself into the woods, and then roast the leg. I know, I just ruined the whole experience, I know. Johnny Carson line, if you will. Yeah.
It's the story about the three-legged pig and the man traveling through the countryside, and he comes upon this farm, and he sees this animal run across from one side of the hill to the other, from this farmhouse to the barnyard, and he's like astounded. He sees this three-legged pig. He stops, and it's a beautiful day, and he goes into the barnyard, and he finds the farmer, and he says, "I swear I just saw a three-legged pig run across." He says, "Oh, yeah, that's my pig." So, well, how is it that he has three legs? So he starts telling this elaborate story about how the draperies one evening caught fire from the little lamp, and the pig saved the farmer and his wife and dragged them out of the burning house. And at another time, he was in the back 40, he was far away, and his tractor tipped over and was pinned under there, and it was the pig that heard him and saved his life and came and got him out from underneath the tractor. And the salesman says, "Well, you haven't told me why the pig only has three legs." He says, "Well, nobody eats an animal like that all at once."
Oh, boy! I'm dead bird!
That's a great joke.
I forgot something.
Oh, 1 second. Wait, Rachel, we're in the middle of this example. Rocky Mountain oysters. So here's the story. You have an animal. You have a, not just any animal. It has to be male, obviously. You have an ox. And the ox's testicles are separated from the rest of its body while it's still alive. But they still remain connected to the actual animal, meaning they don't fall off from the animal's person, I guess, for lack of a better term, but they stay within the area. We have some young ears around. We're all following me. Okay.
You mean the area of his body?
The area of his body. Doesn't become disconnected from his body, but they become seemingly, you know, severed enough from the rest of his, right, from the rest of his, from the rest of its head. So anatomically, they're still basically connected. So the Shulchan Aruch says, or asks, what happens when we shech the animal? Can we eat those? I'm not asking if you want to, I'm asking if you can. May you eat those. Meaning, is that considered Eiver Min Hachai? Do we consider that to be a part of the animal that was severed from its body before it was ever killed? Or do we say that, no, the animal was killed and then it was drained? So he says, It depends. He says, if we can tell that those oysters are still receiving life source from the rest of the body, then we consider them to still be connected. If not, and how would you know? If they stink, if they develop an odor, if they begin to turn green, if they become gangrenous, in all of those instances, we say, despite the fact that they haven't actually physically been removed from the body, we still consider them to be disconnected and severed enough that it's not really considered part of the animal anymore. So, If they are part of the animal, you can eat them. If they're not part of the animal, despite the fact that they are still contained within the animal's skin, they are not. They may not be eaten. What does that mean then? What that means is that there's a. I saw this example. It's a great proof text from Rav Moshe David Tendler, who is one of the major advocates for halachic organ donation. Says, what does that mean? What does that tell you? What that tells you is that there is such a notion, even in halacha, of something being anatomically connected but physiologically disconnected, meaning it can actually physically be part of the body, be attached to the body, the skin is still holding it together, but halachically speaking, we don't consider it to be part of the animal anymore. Meaning it's possible for a human being to become decapitated halachically, despite the fact that the skin from his neck leading up to his head, from his shoulders up to his head, still seems to be attached. You're going to go to the principal's office, the two of you.
We are.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about the opposite situation with these oysters?
Yeah.
Where, I mean, I lived in Colorado in the Rocky Mountains. In every spring, there was, you could call it a festival, but it's a delicacy. And they're not on the confines of the beast any longer.
Right. And the beast is still alive. And the beast is still alive.
They're going into a
totally prohibited. Not just for you, but for every
it's the same story
for
as the leg.
For each member of the 7 billion human race club.
Same story as the leg.
Yeah, yeah, that is totally prohibited for each one of the 7 billion people living on planet Earth. Yeah, from our perspective, yeah.
So how is that a
bad thing?
Boys.
How does that give a pro-donation analysis?
Meaning what this suggests then is that something might still be anatomically connected to the body, but halakhically, meaning it's still within the skin of the animal, but halakhically speaking, if it's effectively dead, because it develops an odor and because it becomes gangrenous or whatever, then we would consider it to be detached, halakhically speaking.
So
that would be pro-donation in the sense that we could then apply that to the notion of the right
head.
The human being being decapitated even though his head is still attached.
Yeah, but if and maybe I'm misunderstanding, but if the organs are turning gangrenous and whatever, then they're not going to be.
Well, in the particular case of the ox, we have, I guess, the luxury of being able to give it some time and see what happens. In the case of the human being, we don't necessarily. But conceptually, if this, and also because the it'll run out at some point. The heart will stop. Well, I don't even know. I mean, conceptually, if you kept the respirator going even without the brain, at some point that's not gonna.
At some point, they'll get
it's gonna fail.
And die.
Okay, so you have a far more limited window, but at least conceptually what that points to is that something might be anatomically connected, but we would still consider it to be halakhically severed. And then we can apply that as well, perhaps, to the head of a human being who is brain dead, who has suffered brain stem death, even though his heart is still beating. That's the application. Yeah.
How does the death of Robert Schneerson fit in with this? Because
who says he died?
you got a point there.
That was good.
I object. Yeah.
He was brain dead about 48 hours before he actually died. But they would not declare him dead until his heart stopped.
Yeah, we're still waiting for them to declare. this entire issue, there's a distinction, first of all, between brainstem death and, help me out, you know, the upper regions of the cerebral death, right? Meaning a person can be, according to halacha, a person can absolutely be a vegetable for months and still be considered alive. What we're speaking about specifically is brain stem death because it's going to control the organs, right? They're also, I mean, now I don't know exactly, you know, medically what took place. It may be exactly what we're talking about, but nevertheless, we're not going to we don't abide by this definition that brain stem
right.
death
they
is considered
to
death.
Heart to stop,
yeah, right.
Which is
right.
Also a traditional.
Right, so that's what, yeah. Yeah, the flip side of all of this, right, if we say that brainstem death is not death, then it's not breathing, right, it's not the lungs which are controlled by the brain, but it is the beating of the heart. That we don't, and we'll get to that in the next slide. Yeah, Danny.
So if you slaughter the whole beast, you still can't have the oysters because they're...
You are really hung up on this. You can, sure. You
aren't they too far back on the animal?
No, that's not an issue.
That's not it?
Yeah, that's not it. That's the sciatic nerve.
Seventh.
If they kill the animal,
you can't have your breath.
Yeah, you can, you know, you can
take a calf and...
Do what you got to do. Okay. Looking at that same example, that same case of the lizard, analyze it being con donation, being against organ donation. How would we look at that? That first of all, and it's very clear, the Mishnah's discussion, the beginning of the Mishnah speaks about human beings, and then at the end begins to speak about animals. Right. How do you know if an animal is dead? Well, once it's decapitated, even though the tail continues to gyrate, nevertheless, we still consider the animal dead. We say that about animals, not human beings.
We're saying not just at the tip. This was the truth is this was not a great picture.
No. She had a picture with the head chopped.
It should have been with the head chopped off, and then the tail continues to flop. Right, right. I mean, that could be no different from having a leg amputated and still being able to.
Generally speaking, lose their tails many times
when
they climb. They go on.
Right.
They regenerate.
So yeah, it wasn't a great picture. Yeah.
But that's another tail.
That's what I meant. That's why. So what would we say? First of all, that the Mishnah's definition only applies to animals, that we have a totally, totally different set of rules that need to be applied and need to be worked with and that we operate under when it comes to the definition of a human being. There is no such thing, according to at least one school of thought, that you could have independent movement of either organs or limbs of a human being and still declare that human being to be dead. If there is still movement, like the heart pumping or like any other functioning of the limbs or organs, then that human being is still alive, irrespective of what we say about a lizard. Another approach is that perhaps if we just saw a leg continue to flex or move or gyrate or whatever, that would be one thing. But what we're speaking about with the tail is just a limb. It's localized movement, it's not centralized movement, meaning a heart that then pumps blood all throughout the entire body, or most of the body, save the head. But if that continues to be the case, that blood is continuing to flow because the heart continues to pump it throughout the body, then that human being is still dead, and that really, the case of the lizard really has absolutely no bearing on what we're talking about here. Also, that brainstem death doesn't mean destruction of the entire brain, right? There are other components to the brain that we may or may not be destroyed. But in any event, when we speak about the notion of decapitation,
the brain ain't going to function without the brainstem.
No, it's not going to function. It's not going to function. But there's a distinction between saying that the entire thing has turned into a total putty or mush or whatever, and saying that it's still in there and still physically, you know, joined to the rest of the body. It's just not the same as decapitation, no matter what tests you want to run that prove that we don't have blood flow to that area anymore.
In the old days, if somebody lost their leg, it was amputated. I'd have to save the leg wait until the person is dead and then bury the leg with the body.
Not just the olden days, we still do.
No, I know, but in the olden days, how did they do that?
Well, in the olden days, you had a burial plot, I mean, shortly after you were born.
Yeah.
I mean, it was because there was the town cemetery, and there were family plots, and there were...
So you buried your plot?
You buried your plot, yeah. Many people still do. Many people still do. You know, you arrange a plot, you know, early on, yeah.
Take the, it's take actually... The leg and throw it in there now, and just wait until the rest of you die?
Yeah. I wouldn't put it like that. Yeah, I'm putting the leg, I'm just waiting. Wait until the rest of me goes, you know. I can wait. You live the rest of your life fully, and then you get buried. And then, well, right. You're on a roll. Naomi and then Edith.
How long, I mean, how do you keep a leg? Somebody, let's say, is in a car accident, has their leg amputated.
I believe they bury it immediately. Maybe they keep it in freeze. But I don't think so. I think it's buried immediately.
That's what I was about to ask.
I think it's buried immediately.
So do you say that for yourself?
Yeah.
Just the end.
Just the
end.
He's joking.
Just the tail end. The air of suicide bombing and the fibrofiducia runs in. You see it on the news all the time.
Right.
They recover limbs from persons who otherwise live.
Right.
So my question is, are they buried in some sort of identity?
I don't know. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I don't know.
So
don't know.
It can be set aside when the mace is actually finally.
I don't know. You could do DNA if they went that route. You could do DNA tests on every limb that's found.
Into the earth, well, where the mace is going to be interred.
Well, I don't know if they know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Very interesting. I don't know.
Right. I'm sure there's a protocol.
Yeah. I'm not sure. It's interesting. Yeah. Final point, and this is really much
much quicker question to really address, because there really is consensus about this. Receiving organs. Okay, so now, first of all, the notion of receiving organs obviously only arises, right, as a question if you are of the opinion, if you're of the school of thought, that we cannot say that brainstem death is death. If we can't, right, if we can't say that brainstem death is death, then what happens? That means that I can't donate organs, right? I can't say that upon, 120 years, upon my deathbed, they'll be able to harvest the organs to be able to use for other people. If I'm not willing to say that, now I find myself in a real pickle, because can that school of thought then accept organs? What are you basically saying by saying that we will receive an organ? You're saying, let's just get our definitions down really clearly. If I believe that the only way to determine if a person is dead halachically is once his heart stops beating, so then I can't donate my organs. One cannot donate his organs. So that's basically saying that to harvest organs just based upon brainstem death, even though the heart is still beating, is murder. You're killing the person. That's why the stakes are so high here, because we're dealing with life and death. That's why this is so critical and so difficult, such a difficult conversation to really have. So if we say that it's death, then what am I saying by signing my name on that list? I'm saying, sure, kill that person and give me his kidney.
You're sanctioning murder.
I'm sanctioning murder. So Eric doesn't think so.
No, I don't believe that.
Well, we go...
I don't believe that, but if you're halachically... I mean,
you're not killing the person. The person just naturally...
So this becomes the... This becomes the argument. So those who believe... Yeah, Danny. And then we'll get into the two sides.
No, you're not a doctor, but just throwing it out. Is there a few moments that this person has died halachically that the organs are still usable?
No.
There isn't?
If you talk about heart death, I mean,
I don't know. Like, I mean, as soon as a heart stops, is the kidney spoiled?
No, but we wait longer than as soon as the heart stops, because we need to make sure it really stopped.
So is that 5 minutes?
Whatever, if it's 5 or 6 or 7, whatever it is medically, it's too long.
It is?
It's just too long.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's too, yeah.
I honestly thought yeah.
That's what the issue is. That's why this is such an issue.
Because usually, and also the heart's not going to stop like that. It's going to be slowing down. You're going to have low blood flow.
And that's our issue, because we need to give it substantial time for us to say that the heart has really stopped. And by that time, that we can say that once the rabbis can say that the heart has really stopped, the doctors are already saying that we can't use these organs anymore.
So, yeah, because sometimes they say someone's kidneys failed, but the rest of them work.
Oh, that'll sure.
So that's called dialysis.
We need right, but we. I mean, you can live like that. You can live like that. But we're speaking about the reverse, where at the core, once it's failed and we know that it's failed, everything else has also.
5 minutes after the heart stops, they can't take it out anymore.
Too late. It's too late. Yeah, Richard, and then Eric.
The reason the stopping of the heart is such a prominent part is throughout the ancient world, breath has always been connected with soul. And many times the word, in certain Semitic languages, many Semitic languages, the words for breath and soul is the same word.
The Chasam Sofer, who we first saw, actually, that's one of the things that he points to. When he says that the Gemara says that once the person has stopped breathing, that absolutely is the definition of death. He says, after all, you go back to the very beginning of the creation narrative, where God creates man. It says that he breathed into his nostrils the soul, the living soul. So once we don't have any breath coming out of the nostrils anymore, that is absolutely the halachic definition of death. Period. Now, having said that, the truth is that at least within Jewish sources, we tend to link the brain to the soul more than any other organ.
Because we're intellectuals.
Well, it's like a chicken and an egg kind of thing. But, or is it that we're intellectuals because we believe that to be the seed of spirituality? So that part is interesting, which also may play into both sides of the argument, that once the brain is dead, then the body is dead, irrespective of what's happening with the organs. That's really meaningless. And even on the flip side, so long as the head is still attached, even if we don't think that there's any more functioning, any more brain activity, worthwhile brain activity, after all, the brain is the seat of the soul. If it's still attached to the body, then we don't view that as there really being a severance between the two. It may play into both sides, even subconsciously. Yeah.
So I wasn't able to attend the workshop, the Cypress Beach workshop we had a few weeks ago, but what is the number of hours that passes from the time the body, I guess, is declared dead until the time that...
That they do the Tara? So the Tara is done, it's not a function of when the person dies, it's a function of when the funeral is. The Tara is usually done as close to the funeral as possible. In ideal circumstances, those are all as adjacent to one another as absolutely possible. In theory, if somebody, let's even say in Israel, because in Israel they do burials at night also.
Okay.
We're not allowed to here. But there are night funerals in Israel. So in Israel, if a person dies, you know, the Chevra Kedisha might pick up the body within a half hour,
okay,
have the body transported. They're probably performing a Tara, you know, within an hour, and then doing the burial immediately thereafter.
Really?
It depends on how, you know, many... When Rav Ovadia Yosef passed away, they needed additional time because they were expecting, and they got, hundreds of thousands of people. But in an ordinary circumstance, it could be done really rapidly.
So it could be just a matter of 2 hours?
Potentially, yeah.
So Steve... How quickly can you really harvest an organ and it'll still be viable?
No, this is all done before the Tara. I mean, this is all... The order of procedure here is that while the person is still on the hospital bed, or while it was still in the hospital, they're harvesting the organs and...
Sure about that.
That's right. That's the procedure. That would be the procedure, you know, if we would... It depends on whether or not you accept that definition in the first place. But if you do, if you're working with that definition...
That time difference is not an issue here.
No, this is all happening before any of the other, you know, rituals are even commenced. Yeah.
I just wanted to bring up something that I've seen, and I wonder how it affects this. I went on Grand Rounds, where they had a skeletal pathologist that was brought in, and they had a patient that had been in an automobile accident. He was now lying in bed. He had no functions whatever, except that he was breathing and he was staring at the ceiling, and he had no stimuli of any type.
Right.
And he'd been alive this way for several months, and they were bragging to this skeletal pathologist they brought in. That they had saved this guy, and his response to that was, "What have you saved?"
Right.
Because this was just a body laying on a sheet on the bed, breathing.
Right.
But had no functions whatever. Brain was dead.
How were the lungs?
He was breathing.
He lost his higher function of the brain.
A higher function. He was a vegetable, but brainstem was alive. Yeah. So it's a very tough sort of scenario. In Jewish law and tradition, we would say that I'll tell you what you saved. What you saved is a life. And even though there is not any remnant of what we would commonly call quality of life, it's still life. And that comes with an extremely high value that we place on that. Now, having said that, here's a really unfortunate situation in which such a person is sort of trapped between the two. Right, where according to both definitions, if his heart is still beating, which it must have been, and if his brain stem is still active, which it must have been, then he's still alive, irrespective of whatever, you know, what we would call quality of life. Having said that, who knows what exactly is going on in a person's soul at the time.
Used to call pneumonia the old man's friend, but anyway, that's a different story.
You see it.
You know what they do. Medicare will no longer pay for this because the patient isn't making any progress. So if you want to keep this person alive, the family's going to have to come up with the money, which is something like, what, $50,000 a day or something like that. Phenomenally expensive. And so sometimes it becomes a decision of the family.
But this isn't a person on a respirator. This is a person who's just stuck, right?
He's alive.
He's alive.
He's
a vegetable.
No stimuli.
Right.
He's just lying there.
He's not on a med.
He's not on a
feeding tube either.
No.
Okay.
Well, eventually he'd starve to death.
Yeah. Which, by the way, is a whole other, I mean, end of life issue in terms of when you do and when you don't have to supply food is a whole other thing that will. Yeah.
Get back to the point here.
Any other restrictions on receiving?
That's what we're trying to talk about. Yeah. So receiving, the again, if
you're
we're only from the perspective of this being a problem. If this not being death, right? If brainstem death is death, then I can give. So if I can give, then there's nothing wrong with receiving. The issue is, perhaps, does this make me complicit in murder? Because if I hold that brainstem death is not death, that you can't take my own kidney because that'll basically be killing me while I'm laying on my deathbed at 120, so then I also can't, that entire school of thought, you know, no one who subscribes to that school of thought could then be put in a position, potentially, where they say, yeah, but sign me up, shouldn't kill me, but you can kill the other guy. give me his stuff.
No.
So what most point to, and by the way, this is also used as a chip to a certain extent in the argument to say, therefore, you have to succumb to the acceptance of brainstem death being death. You have to allow that to really rule as the definition. Otherwise, we're caught in this horrible position, in this horrible fix. But in truth, even those who believe that only cardiac death is the true definition of halachic death say that the fact is there's no actual causal link here. Meaning, if Yankee as a Jew does or does not sign his name onto a list, every available organ will be plucked out of every person who signs themselves up for that sort of thing. Now, again, the other side of the argument is, but still, once you're saying that this is death, how do you put yourself in that position? And the other side is, but we're talking about matters of life and death, even if it's uncomfortable, because I'm saying that it's that I'm not going to allow it to be done to myself, we're talking about potentially saving either my own life or somebody else's life. The fact is, these organs are going to be harvested, right or wrong. If we could push a button and make the whole thing disappear, then perhaps we would. And perhaps you would say that, you know what,
there's a mass murder going on. Oh, they'd be killed anyway, whether I intervene or not. They'll all be dead.
I don't know if it's a question of intervening or not. It's a question of making use of a crime.
I understand.
But it's like dirty money.
Yeah, it's dirty money.
It's like
everybody
dirty money.
Everybody does it. Therefore,
well, I don't know about everybody does it, but it's
pretty close.
But it's saying that it's dirty money.
The receiver's exempt.
Do you? What's that?
The receiver's exempt.
What do you mean?
Well, the receiver isn't bound by the donor's issues.
Let's say it's like, you know, a guy is a crook.
Right.
Around, member of the mafia. He's going to donate money to the show.
Right. Right.
Except his money.
Yeah. How much is it?
By the way, it becomes a similar sort of argument. One of the examples that I saw is it right to make use? Is it right to make use of scientific discoveries discovered by the Nazis that were found out while experimenting on Jewish subjects?
They didn't find anything. Okay.
But that's the question.
Well,
no, but that's the question. If it would save a Jewish life, would you do so? So then is that in some way, I mean, it's a very difficult conversation. It's a very difficult argument. On the one hand, we say, I'm not condoning the act, and if I could have pushed a button and made that whole thing disappear and then see this person die, I would. But that's not the reality. The reality is that the crime happened anyway. So then do I say, the crime is happening anyway? The fact is, these organs are going to be harvested irrespective of my name on a list. Do I then not allow myself, for the sake of standing on ceremony, is that like cutting off my nose to spite my face?
Okay, such an individual who believes that and still would receive.
Right.
Well, then wouldn't it be incumbent upon him, since he thinks it's murder,
right,
to publicly get up and say, this is murder, we shouldn't do it?
Yeah, maybe.
You wouldn't.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be the only way you could defend it.
Yeah.
Then you'd really get attacked in this.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, talking about cutting off your nose to spite your face, I mean, if people are going to understand that sort of a statement, but basically, at the very least, that means that internally, you have to really honestly believe that if you could have pushed a button and allowed yourself to die and have saved the country from mass, wide-scale murder, that you would have done so. It's a very, very difficult sort of even realization to have, let alone standing up even on the soapbox and be able to make that kind of statement. It's very, very, very difficult. Just the two quick, and I'm happy to stick around for questions afterwards, but just quick conclusion. First of all,
okay,
to realize how high the stakes are in either direction. That's why this is such an important topic. That's why this is such a hot topic. That's why this is such a hotly contested debate. Because no matter which way you go, these are the kinds of moral corners that we paint ourselves into by saying on the one hand that we cannot accept, that we cannot allow for brainstem death to be treated as a halachic definition of death. It means that we might be in position, we are in position then, to tell the Jewish community, yes, you should receive, but you can't give, and you can't give because it's murder, but you could still have somebody else be murdered so that you can receive. Very trying, very uncomfortable position to be in, on the one hand. And yet on the other hand, does that then force my hand to say that what I believe to be murder now isn't, because I put myself in a very compromising kind of situation? The stakes are extremely high. The hope, and this is like the final conclusion really, is that hopefully we get to a point where this all becomes irrelevant. And
yeah, it'll become worse. Don't worry.
It'll become worse. Well, it may become worse before it gets better, but it might get better at some point.
Fire!
It might get better at some point.
Through
whatever sorts of
artificial
advancements,
organs.
Artificial or stem cell research, etc., we're able to actually grow organs potentially on our own and all of that.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I see a piece of fire.
A piece of fire right in the middle of it, like a cyborg heart. So who knows if we'll get to that point?
As a practical preface it with this question. You said that although there's currently a divide among the poskim, what does it come down to?
Comes down to this issue.
Well, I mean, is there a majority and minority? Are there some that are of greater weight of authority than others?
There's many
things we have to, like you look at a kosher hechsher. You have to decide whether you're going to follow that particular hechsher or not.
It's just so impossible to answer the question.
Like, which rabbi are you going to follow?
Right. That's what it comes down to is which rabbi are you comfortable with and which one are you going to follow?
Are there groups?
Sure.
Are there
groups? So which one has more halachic veracity? Depends which group you ask.
That's
life, and that's Judaism.
He wants to see what authority he's relying on.
That's why life is so complicated. That's why Judaism said there's no easy answer. That's true of Kashrus and of Shabbos. It's true of lots and lots of... It's true of who... Zionism, right? Religious Zionism. Do we back the state of Israel or do we not? Well, some authorities say absolutely yes and some authorities say absolutely no. Yeah. Who has more halachic veracity? Depends who you ask. Well, who am I going to ask? Depends who you're comfortable asking.
Right, second, choose one question. As a practical matter, the observant Jew who wants to make an informed intellectual decision about the donation of his organs,
right?
What does he have to do to specify that his organs would be harvested?
So there is a group that's come together called HODES, Halachic Organ Donation Society.
There you go.
Which espouse the views in favor of saying that organ donation is acceptable because of brainstem death being treated as the halachic definition. And I don't know exactly what's done, but I believe what they do is ensure that there's some sort of rabbinic authority from their group that attests to the fact that it's not exclusively, that the call is not exclusively being made by whatever physicians are present, but also some sort of rabbinic authority as well, and help to just coach the whole process along, basically.
In an individual case?
I think so. I'm not certain. You could visit their website.
Are there any medical guidelines, quote, medical guidelines, that are set up by this group?
The same way.
So that the medical.
Yes, and they work with that. Yeah, but yes.
Guided in an individual case.
Yes.
And these are the same.
That's what part of it is. Yeah. Meaning, once you say that this is for me, then by getting in with their society, they help to coach you through all that. The same way that the Aguda, develops protocol, and the RCA develops protocol for helping coroners deal with as halachic as possible an autopsy. Meaning if you need to do an autopsy, so then what do we do to ensure that as best as possible we're maintaining the basic legal code that the Jews need in order to then subsequently perform a tahara and do a proper burial? So yeah, so they help and they guide and they coach when these kinds of things come up. Yeah, Richard.
Listen, are you allowed to donate your body with the assumption that some medical students are going to learn about medicine so that they can save people?
No. There isn't a direct enough effect on saving a life. We pikuach nefesh only goes so far. There needs to be a very clear link. Yeah.
So you focus. You said, if I understood, that the main issue is when is death to decide whether it's permitted or not. But what if you agree that death has to do with brainstem, which makes it more acceptable. But there's also the belief of maintaining the whole body.
Right.
So then wouldn't it be, isn't that a way to say, well, I can receive, but I can't give because I can't donate because I need to have my whole body?
I mean, I think practically, politically, socially, it puts you in just as difficult a position, meaning to turn to the broader, secular community and say, I need you to give it, I need your kidney because after all, you can be cremated, but I can't because my body's more special than yours. I mean, it becomes a very difficult conversation to have. Whenever we get into these areas of it's good enough for you, but it's not good enough for me, it becomes trying. For some reason, this society, halachic organ donation society, this seems to be, in halachic terms, this seems to be more of a hotly contested issue about the actual definition of death rather than that kavod hamet issue, which seems to be easier to work through, get around,
Because there are other people who have other beliefs, and so if they believe that it's acceptable to donate, then might argue.
Right. I mean, you're right that internally that might be, meaning as far as my own personal belief, I might maintain that this is absolutely not murder, but I still can't have it done to my own body because of kavod hamet, but I can accept it from, let's say, a Gentile donor. Internally, I might be able to believe that, but it still becomes a very difficult position to take up in terms of the conversation with the greater organ donation community. Other questions? Thanks, guys. Oh, question. Oh, we'll schmooze after. Thanks for joining, everybody. Thank you. Thank you.